Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. Today's episode is a bit different from our usual format. I recently held a webinar called The Evolving Power of ESG, Generating Returns and Communicating with Clients, where we discuss some key areas of interest to fund managers and investors, given the growing momentum, latest trends, and key developments in the industry. I was joined in conversation by Esa Salaranta, Head of ESG and Sustainable Technology at EQ PLC. The webinar is part of a series in the build-up to the ESG Investment Europe event on 27 and 28th of May in London. So make sure you join us at the event if you can make it as well. This is another initiative we have taken at ILA and Partners in partnership with Reuters Event by Thomson Reuters to continue with our efforts to promote and scale sustainable and impact investing. I hope you enjoyed it.
Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning if you're in the United States. Welcome to our latest Reuters Event ESG webinar. This one is on the evolving power of ESG, generating returns and communicating with clients. This webinar has been hosted in conjunction with the ESG Investment Europe event, which we're hosting on the 27th and 28th of May, and also the ESG Investment USA event, which we're hosting later in the year on the 22nd and 23rd of September. And you're all obviously welcome to join us for those events in person at that date, and we'll be sending across more information after the webinar. So today we have Esa from EQ PLC, and we have JP from ILA and Partners, who will be delivering the content today. They'll start with a couple of short presentations, and then we'll get into more of a discussion. So please feel free to be sending in your questions throughout, and we will get to them at the end. So JP, if you'd like to start off.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much and to Reuters Events as well for organizing this, especially to you, Tom Crocott, and Luke Brett as well for the great work they are doing in organizing such an important event and coming ESG Investment Europe. Thank you, Esa Salaranta, for joining us and taking the time, especially given the latest kind of events and developments in the market.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, as you mentioned, Dom, evolving power of ESG, generating returns and communicating with clients, you know, more relevant than ever before. I think we will have an interesting conversation, as you mentioned, also taking questions to learn kind of how ESA has successfully managed to do what he's doing so listeners can hear firsthand examples that they can relate to and ideally be able to apply to their businesses, as well as their own transition into sustainable and impact investing. So to start, I'll take five minutes or so to share a couple of slides and thoughts to set the scene and high-level background on what is happening and how ILA and Partners is trying to help. So I think everyone's going to agree that we are facing some of the biggest challenges humanity has ever faced, and now more than ever. But trying to stay positive, you know, we still believe that these kind of big problems that we have facing so far, you know, are bringing bigger opportunities. Obviously, making sustainable investing helping the world is hard work. But some companies are making progress and are taking advantage of it. One of those is ESA himself with EQ. But it's not happening fast enough and at scale, so there's a lot to do, and that's why we're here to help. Very quickly, just to set a bit of context, you know, the market, let's say, is about $300 trillion of investable assets right now, or maybe not declining as of today, but only the 30 trillion of these are in sustainable investing. However, this has grown 38% on the last 2 years alone, according to the Global Sustainable Investment Alliance report. As you can see in this slide I'm looking at right now, the kind of known strategies as per the report as well are about seven, of which the top ones keep being a negative exclusion, screening and ESG integration and corporate engagement. Obviously, we have norms-based, positive best-in-class screening, sustainability theme investing, and impact investing. I would recommend at this point that people do listen to the previous webinar called Taking ESG Mainstream, which was also hosted with by Reuters, which touches on this in more detail and the trends that we're seeing in 2020 and beyond. In terms of the opportunity, again, I want to stress and highlight, you know, sustainable impact investing is becoming the most relevant opportunity to create returns while doing good and helping effectively save the world. You know, I will take just a few seconds to quote, you know, some of the people that are driving this from a long time ago. Al Gore, previous US Vice President and Chairman of Generation IM, said that sustainable revolution is gaining momentum and it now represents the single greatest investment opportunity in all of history. And then we also have Larry Fink saying a couple of days ago that, you know, I believe that we are on a situation, on an edge of a significant relocation of capital, and that investors have to really reassess their portfolios because of sustainability issues. And obviously, everyone is aware of how he has been pushing through his letters in the last couple of years. So demand, obviously, for those reasons and beyond is increasing as investors finish their duties, focus deeper on sustainability. And people of all generations are raising the awareness of climate change and the impact. I won't touch too much into the detail. You can see there that obviously institutional investors, and they have been, some of them more than others, have been raising their allocations. And also there are a couple of reports now in terms of, you know, the pension funds in different countries. In this case, in the US, where 64% of the US pension funds are expressing their interest on allocation into sustainable investing, sustainable finance. And European corporations have 60% or more of their institutional shareholders employing sustainability strategies. This is according to the Sustainable Finance Institute and the World Economic Forum. Very quickly, to finish on kind of the main drivers that we are facing, we have obviously the risks that we are all becoming more and more aware about. The UK SIF report of last year, you know, showed us that definitely a small percentage of investment managers are really doing a lot on this. And we can see here there's going to have a huge impact on valuations and performance, driven by potential litigations, regulation, and transition, and others. And in terms of regulations, just to also highlight, especially in the UK, we're seeing a lot of that. And obviously the consequence of reporting attached to that. We had a wave of updates and changes such as the FRC stewardship code that is just kicked in this year, redefining the requirements and expanding to all participants and asset classes. We have the UK pension regulator focusing on sustainability, ESG and climate change risk, and many more, including obviously the EU guidelines, the TFCD and the FCA coming more likely than not this year with a specific requirement. In terms of ILA and partners, just in case you didn't know us yet, we provide advisory services for investment managers that want to transition into sustainable and impact investing. In order to generate and protect alpha, increase returns and manage risk, we mainly focus on working on the strategy with the owners and the senior management of the companies, and also obviously on measurement, product and distribution, and we help through the crucial stages of a transition process. We are a collective of advisors and partners forming a very insightful and outstanding team, which brings a reputation with widely recognized people that have been committed to making a change for decades, experience in terms of bringing value to market, and a vast network of best practices. And also wanted to just share with you what we're trying to achieve in case you can help us and work with us. But we have aspirational targets, which is at this point divided into three, which is working directly with funds to achieve 5 billion of direct funding committed to sustainable impact investing by 2022. We're trying to work with institutions to influence so that we can achieve 100 billion of committed funding to sustainable impact investing by 2025. And that's in these two cases, as you know, sometimes it sounds harder or easier than what it is. Obviously, we have a lot of companies making great announcements, such as RBC last year already committing 100 billion into similar targets and goals. I think that we, as you can tell, from 30 trillion out of 300, we have a long way to go. And we also want to reach as many people as possible to make people aware at every level, especially in financial services industry, but beyond as well. And the way that we're doing this, we have a couple of initiatives, including the Impact Leaders podcast, which I will recommend people to go and listen if they want to listen to some of the best investors in the market. Including ESA as well, who is in there, and among other things that we do. And finally, if you want to reach out to us and learn more or discuss, please, my details, you can connect with me on LinkedIn or call me or email me. So now, ESA, back to you. Welcome. Thank you so much once again for joining us. I know that you want to do a quick introduction as well, and then we will do a couple of questions, and obviously we will be receiving potentially some questions from the listeners. So welcome.
Thanks, JP. Thank you very much, and welcome all wherever you are. And I thought I would welcome you with a couple of slides only. I'm not going to be really burdening you with a 15-page slide deck at all, just a few slides in order to give a little bit of a background. And I thought I'd write down for myself and for you all the main purpose of the kind of areas that I would like to discuss and share my experiences on, and also kind of make you aware of. And I think the first question here is I think it's key to us all, is the question, does ESG make really companies better? I mean, is it going to lead into companies behaving in a better way, taking care of the planet and delivering goods in a better way? So I think that's one of the key questions to begin with. And also, from an investment point of view, equally important is that does ESG make actually better investment returns? And that's debatable, and obviously the track record for many of the funds is relatively short because this hasn't been around for a long enough period and long enough to analyze fully the returns in different market circumstances. But we have some indicative results already, and we can discuss that later on. Also, what I'd like to touch on is, does ESG reveal really better quality in the companies? I mean, is there something in the ESG processes that actually gives you more really important information about the companies and their quality above what the financial analysis typically kind of goes into and reaches? And then, how do we communicate ESG processes? I mean, what's actually there? What are we doing? As if we say that we have a sustainability fund, what does the fund actually do? I mean, what's really in it, that is different from perhaps other traditional fund management processes? And finally, how can the fund investors see the ESG in action? But how does the process become something of a reporting that fund investors can easily understand what's happening there and how can they make comparisons between different funds, non-ESG and ESG, and even make separation and distinctions between different types of ESG funds and, you know, what is the kind of a product that best suits them. So I think those are really important questions. And, you know, hopefully we will be able to drill deep into those during the process of this webinar. And then who am I? Well, I've been 30 years working in the global financial markets. I'm old enough to have been using Reuters dealing screens in the late 80s. So I've been working in this industry now for over five decades. And out of those, about 15 years managing different types of funds, mostly previously energy and infrastructure related funds, also real estate. And the current fund that I've been running now for 5 years is called EQ Blue Planet, and that's a sustainable technology and social sustainability fund, which is investing in global equities. EQ is a firm, is a Finnish independent financial firm where we run about 10 billion euros of assets in real estate, in private equity, in the traditional equity and fixed income markets as well. So that we are a sort of a full-scale operation and very much focused here on our Finnish clients. Maybe the background of my own perspective as well. I mean, being a Nordic investor, it's certainly been an opportunity to follow how the ESG has been evolving over the years into the mainstream, because the Nordic investors have been in the forefront from the beginning, and it's been a very interesting journey so far. And I think, you know, from my perspective, in looking at those key questions, if it wasn't for ESG or sustainable investing, I don't think I would be managing money that much anymore from a fund managing perspective, because I've done it in the past and I know it sort of works and I've proven myself. But I really took on the journey to see if I can take some of that experience and put it into practice in terms of investing, in order to find out, you know, if I can take something new out of the sustainability process that will even make better investment returns and actually a more meaningful work for myself, and in order to sort of really to feel that there is something of a purpose in what you're doing, and also an impact in a more positive way to the society at large, to the planet. And I think we have to borrow from John Elkington really the key concept that what this all is about is all about people, planet, and profit. And that's I think it's very important as well. So we're always resting on the shoulders or standing on the shoulders of a few giants in this industry. And I think the biggest giant in this industry is obviously Warren Buffett. And I thought I would, to begin with, I would just borrow his you know, one observation that always strikes to me as something which is everlasting and very important. And it was important in 1999, and it still is today, that the key in investing is really to assess the competitive advantage of any given company. And the durability of that advantage. That's really where you will be able to analyze. If you see a company that is going to be sustainable in our kind of a language over the years. And sustainability to me means that the companies that are truly sustainable, they will be able to withstand every kind of a difficult cyclical situation or whatever happens better than companies that are perhaps not so sustainably founded. And then on the bottom half of this slide, you will see a couple of excerpts from a couple of other giants, and one of them is Mark Benioff, the founder of Salesforce.com and currently the co-CEO and chairman of the company as well. Mark is something which, as you know, from the corporate leaders, is really someone who, to me, is a very good example of what the modern era of sustainability actually means in practice when you're leading a business to both amazing results, but at the same time, taking into account what's happening in the society at large. And Mark has been very vocal about a lot of issues. And it's not just, to me, it's not just any kind of a sort of, a, you know, populist attempt to be just a branding or marketing exercise, but he really truly embodies the idea of sustainability and stakeholder capitalism, the way things are developing at the moment into. And the other one is Cisco's Chuck Robbins talking about, I mean, just a very, very sort of, you know, as an example of how, you know, in their communities, if you don't have good teachers and good schools, the best employees will not come to your company because their children and their near ones won't be able to have the full benefits of a good society around them. So, you know, I think the key message here in these two bottom quotes and observations is really the focus that is very important to me is actually on people. Okay, I think people is really the key part of those statements. And when you talk about stakeholder capitalism, and you know, you can argue if the capitalism is dead, really, as Mark Benioff says here, that's, you know, it's debatable. But I think you know, there is a growing realization among the business leaders at the moment that yes, we have to take into account the stakeholders more widely. And I've been studying for a number of years already the B Corporation movement, which is started in the US, but it's a global movement at the moment. And really the B Corporations have shown, owing to their structure, which legally, if you decide to be a benefit corporation legally, you will be able to build a company foundation which is built on truly taking into account other stakeholders in addition to the investors as well. And the success of that movement and some of those companies that have adopted the B Corporation status, I think has led in a way there in the background to many of the companies to realize that, okay, maybe we should actually be adopting some of those practices ourselves. And some of the leading listed companies, such as Danone from France, they have adopted B Corporation statuses for many of their subsidiaries, and they're part of the movement already. But really the success of companies like Patagonia, Ben & Jerry's, Body Shop, and all of these have shown that actually there is an alignment that can really bring good results to the companies as well. At the same time, while they are good for the planet and good for the people, and I think that's really, really very, very interesting, because we're living in a time where we have, you know, we have huge global challenges. You know, not just talking about the virus, which is now the very acute challenge that we're dealing with, and it's already creating a massive chaos. And, you know, when I think about the virus and the coronavirus situation, it kind of reminds me of the way that companies and the society deals with existential threats. And, you know, climate change, for example, is an existential threat, which is developing over a long period of time. It's happening slowly. It's been going on for decades, and people have been talking about it for decades. But yet, relatively little has been actually done about it because it's moving slowly. It's kind of you know, grinding there in the background all the time, inevitably just destroying the planet. But because it's a slow process, we as people are not very well suited to deal with that kind of a process. Because genetically and historically, we are very, very good at dealing with existential threats which arise out of a sudden. We're kind of like a caveman, and there's an animal jumping out of the bush, and we protect ourselves. We are used to that kind of dealing with those kind of existential sudden threats. But something which is moving slowly, we're very, very bad at kind of dealing with, because, you know, they require strategic thinking, systemic thinking, transgenerational decisions. And that's very difficult in politics, for example, because in politics, you have an election cycle. You have things which have a certain limited time frame to get action done. But a lot of these actions, which are really needed, their benefits will be shown over, you know, many decades after. And we have a difficulty dealing with that kind of a system. But what's happening now, if I may carry on a bit more, what's happening now is that because of the, you saw everybody's seen the U.S. Business Roundtable leaders making the same statement that we have to become more stakeholder aware in the way we deal with our business. And, you know, perhaps to me, if you compare with the B Corporation movement as well, you know, that is in some way, it's dealing with an existential threat, but it's dealing with an existential threat at the corporate level, because the customers and the society are now demanding action. And it may be that some of the companies are doing the same thing as the caveman does when somebody jumps out of the bush all of a sudden and say that, hey, what are you doing? You're destroying the planet. Or, I mean, are you taking action, you know, strong enough to actually, you know, get something done, because we need to get something done. And that's the kind of a protective action perhaps that we're seeing with some companies at the moment, that you know, it's the caveman, you know, raising his hands and protecting himself from an existential business threat point of view. And that's why I think we've come to the situation where a lot of companies are now realizing that, because it's gone so long that action has not been taken. And I think the year 2020 has been advertised as the year that we really need to do something about it. But I hope that the current existential threat, which is very severe, will not override all of the sort of the other actions that are needed and definitely need to take place. So remains to be seen, but I'm still hopeful.
Okay. So thank you for that, Esa. I just wanted to bring you back to the point about how this everything that you mentioned, everything on the introduction, and how people see effectively generating advantage on the businesses, on the valuations, to then bringing it to ESG, and how this variance in defining ESG, and I mentioned the different strategies, leads to this confusion and conflict between kind of investment firms, investors, population, policymakers, and the different stakeholders. What is your view about that? And then maybe share with people how you came about with your thesis create and to drive your fund.
Well, I started with the question, with the background was that the Blue Planet Fund has been founded, and it's a reconfiguration of a strategy that was what the fund was doing from 2002, really. And it was an energy and infrastructure fund. So I had the opportunity to actually take my own fund back in 2015 with a question and with a liberty to do whatever I think is the best course of action for the future. And I thought about the energy system in a completely different kind of a way. And I started asking questions like, a much better planet? Okay, what does it look like? Okay, how do people move about in a better planet? How do they do industry? How do they travel? How do they, you know, work in schools, and how do they work in hospitals and healthcare? So in order to, you know, so that we can say that in this better planet, how are they saving resources, which are getting increasingly scarce? So that's the key question. How does it look? So really go and take a look at the future view. What in my mind makes a better planet and a much better planet at that? And then the next question is, how do we get there? Okay, so how do we get to the better planet? What is needed in that process? And then thirdly, what are the companies leading us there? I mean, how can I find, if I have a vision of what the better planet looks like, and I have an idea how to get there, and then thirdly, to find the companies that are really taking us there with their leadership. And if you can then, and the fund is a very concentrated equity fund. It's a global equity fund with about 40 stocks in it. So that I have complete freedom to choose whatever I think is the best from that point of view. And very early on, focus on technology was absolutely a key thing. Because I believe that in a smarter planet and a better planet, we're using resources vastly in a smarter way than we have been ever doing before, or perhaps even in ways that we haven't yet been able to imagine. And I think technology is very key in that process to a better planet, so that we will be able to measure stuff. I mean, with sensors. I mean, increasingly, there's going to be connected devices, which is going to be something like 100 billion in just a few years' time, that we will be able to measure everything real time. We will be able to calculate everything using advanced computing power, real time, very complex calculations, billions of calculations in just a snap of the fingers. And we will be able to respond real time with software to whatever changes need to be done by using the measurements and the computing power and software. So obviously, artificial intelligence has always been a key component in my thinking and the construction of the fund going forward. And that leads to, you know, what's happening in the industry. It leads to what's happening in transportation, going to be happening in transportation. It leads to thinking about how the built environment is using energy, using resources, and how we can optimize our resource usage. And it's leading into how consumers communicate and contract and make transactions with each other in the future, which is more sustainable. I think one of the, you know, just very clear examples of how technology will be key to survival is, you know, these times, these webinars are very useful. I mean, where we can meet people online, massive amounts of people. We can reach out to people very easily online. And I think, you know, it's a sad way to do this example now, real time, but I think we will be shown how much dependent we are in the technology to actually keep on our societies running in a situation like this. So, yes. You know, those were really the kind of key questions in my mind in building out the process. And it's different because I have been able to build that process from really, you know, from clean
from
slate,
the foundation. Yeah.
From the foundation. So it's for me, it's a pretty straightforward process. And then you just start developing tools and analysis, and every process is evolving all the time. You know, this is not a set kind of a piece that you know, will be black box, but we'll be delivering this and this from now into the long into the future, but it's evolving all the time and you learn while you're doing it. And I think I would suggest that that's exactly how people should approach ESG investing as well, is just get going. And then if you have an existing fund, obviously it really depends on the culture of the company that you will be able to integrate ESG processes into the existing investment processes. And we over here, I think this is very typical for the Nordic countries, but we have a company culture which is very nimble to adapt to this. I mean, this is nothing strange for us. We don't have belief systems that even though we have been, some of us have been in markets for 30 years and for decades and doing, managing money in different ways, suiting, each fund manager has their own style. But we don't have belief systems that would say that, okay, well, I mean, this doesn't make sense. I mean, why should we bother? On the contrary, I think, showing examples, I mean, my role is I try to lead by showing examples of how you can get better tools and how you can get more involved with the sustainability processes for other managers as well. So it's, I think it's a kind of a role like John Elkington now in Volans is describing himself as the chief pollinator, which is spreading ideas. I wouldn't call myself a chief of anything, but pollinator is probably a good description of what one tries to do over here.
So basically you looked into this vision of the future, and that's how you started building the model and the process and the models from scratch, integrated, which is you think is easier the way that you've done it, right, and then integrate it into your company. And then in terms of what has happened in the past, 4.5 years or so since you launched, you have quite a success and quite good kind of returns. What can you share to us in terms of what you managed to integrate, call it ESG factors or others, into your models and decision process? So what kind of worked best for you?
Yeah, well, I think for me, really it was surprising how quickly I evolved in my thinking towards looking at social sustainability actually as the one where you can get the best returns out of. I've always been interested in stuff which is very hard to understand, which are kind of abstract in many ways. Although environment is very key, even the Blue Planet name indicates that this is a very environmentally conscious fund. Yes, we have in my category of Morningstar, I think we have the lowest CO2 emission levels of any of the kind of global funds that are being compared. So that is pretty self-evident, and that's actually very easy to get to. If you have 40 stocks in your fund, it's not just avoiding polluters or companies that have a high amount of emissions. It's just because my thinking that I don't think they're on the right side of future history, and I have definitely an inclination to avoid that. So, getting into the hard part, which is the social, that's been driven by having a very large focus on technology companies and data-driven companies, because very early on I realized that data security and data privacy are going to be extremely important for us to be able to mobilize the world utilizing technology in a sustainable fashion. So that if data is not used in a fair and transparent way by the companies who are involved in data, if their data privacy is not respected, all the progress that is needed on our way to a better planet will not happen, because, you know, people will get very frustrated with that sort of situation. So that if you have companies who are making massive amounts of money by looking at your data and selling advertising, if that's all that data can do, then I think we're doomed, because that's not going to be making us any better off into the future, because there will be a revolt of consumers at some point in time. So being aware and increasingly aware of social has led me to kind of think about what's happening inside of these companies in many different ways of looking at social sustainability. And that's how I started focusing on the people as well. What really drives these companies to amazing technologies, to amazing innovations, and amazing results along the way, and fantastic growth. And I started realizing that there actually has to be something more about people in these companies that we have to understand in a better way. So that's been something that I have been very much focusing on in my process as well, because that's really the glue in the whole organization, is that although we're talking about technology, it's really the people and their creativity that actually makes it happen and make these gigantic leaps forward.
So if I take the opportunity there to link it to, let's say, you know, ESG specifically and ESG ratings and the data that you're using to, you know, be able to create your valuations, how do you marry both, and I know that we have talked separately about measurement as well and other tools that you use, but specific to ESG ratings and the data that you need for your models, yeah. How are you managing that?
Yeah, I think ESG ratings, I mean, there are a number of ESG ratings available, and a lot of investors use them, and a lot of the end users, the end clients as well, are very interested in looking at how is my fund's ESG score, how does it look like, how can I make comparisons, and so forth. So the industry is very, financial industry is very quick in responding to a demand. If there is a demand for more ESG, sure and behold, the industry will deliver you data. And that's really happening at the moment as well. So we have various types of ESG ratings, and they're looking at companies, they're rating companies, and giving them numbers and characteristics that you can kind of compare with. The problem there is that a lot of these rating agencies and rating firms, they have different methodological approaches in their rating systems, and it gets very difficult to explain even to an ESG professional the differences between two different rating systems. If your company is, for example, in their reporting using one rating system and the other one is using something else, you can't really easily communicate the differences, because the methodologies can be you know, somewhat different. And famously, some of the rating agencies and some of the rating firms actually give different results to the same company, so that one rating company can give you a very good number or a result for company A, and the other one is not so good. So how can this be? So that's really sort of one of the first observations that I took, and the second one is that a lot of the rating firms rely on publicly available data, which is typically in our industry something which is easily measured. Well, you can measure easily CO2 emissions, you can measure easily waste, you can measure water usage, some characteristics of your company's diversity, even how many women, how many different minorities, etc. So there are things that are easy to measure. And they typically end up also in the company's ESG reporting, but also in the actual final ESG rating. So if it's easier to measure, that ends up typically in the reporting. What that leaves out then is the stuff which is hard to measure. And going forward and thinking about, so if we have a set of ESG ratings and we know which are the best companies, and if we think about there's a deluge of money going into ESG funds, and let's assume that everybody will be looking at these ratings and you know allocating capital to the best rated companies regardless of the rating system, but it's just a huge amount of money. What that leads into potentially is a factor where the ratings will be directing returns over a short period of time. But in order for a fund manager and a fund firm to differentiate with their returns, if everybody's using the same data, you won't get different results. You will get exactly the same results, or yes. Well, you know, pretty much. So it will come over time, potentially that will become a crowded place. So my second question, my second question in the bullet points is that, will that give you better returns? And my answer kind of is that, well, that depends. It depends on if you're managing money in an active fashion, such as what I'm doing, or if you're constructing index funds or ETF funds. And if there's a deluge of money going into the index and ETF funds, all using pretty much the same types of metrics, the results over time will probably be pretty similar to
everybody else. Fast investing.
Yeah,
and all pushed by costs and fees, right? That's a conversation for another webinar altogether.
Yeah, that's probably the danger that we are as an industry over promising results over a longer period of time. It has worked out pretty well at the moment. I mean, if you look at the past few years, the results are pretty good. I mean, all of the ESG return measurements show more or less that there is something of an advantage that has been gained, but it remains to be seen if that will be sustainable longer into the future. Now, if you're an active manager, you have to define a unique process and a unique way to look at, you know, companies and you're using data in a unique fashion as an investment professional. And it's not just using, you know, building your own data sets, but it's the ways how you actually use that data to an advantage. An advantage means in our industry, it's a bit of a different way of looking at things. And that's my take on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just thinking about then a bit of kind of ESG reporting combined with communicating kind of with clients. So we had a couple of questions coming through from Laura, for example, who a couple of times asked about, you know, should fund management companies report on ESG separately from returns and attribution or include ESG and impact in regular periodic reports, right? And I think that is almost like two customers here, right? One kind of the regulators and one the investors, or do you see this as one and the same?
Well, we report ESG in together with standard, you know, traditional reporting. So that's typically the CO2 levels. It's there's a couple of various factors that we report to the clients. I think the demand on the regulatory side will be definitely to increase reporting on ESG. That's going to happen, that's for sure. And we are very much at the beginning of that. So everybody will be needed to report on ESG in a wider fashion. Now, impact, very interestingly that the question raised as well. That's again a different type of a challenge, because impact measurement needs to develop into a state where we can analyze not just what the companies are reporting and in their CSR reports and what their transparency is and what are the sort of very easily measurable items, but impact reporting and the actual impact of a fund is even a bit more complicated, and it's very difficult sometimes to actually explain how your fund and a portfolio will impact the society, the customers, the health, you know, of the customers and what they need, their values, and the supply chain and all of the other stakeholders. So that is a very wide discussion. And I think that's where the industry is going towards with an increasing focus, because the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations, that is gaining more of an attention with some of our clients. They are demanding more information about what kind of an impact do we have on the SDG level, and not just what the companies are reporting on the ESG level. So those are really two different challenges. But I think the industry is definitely moving gradually towards looking at the impact as well.
Okay. So in terms of the report in itself, then you're saying it's going to continue to increase in terms of regulators asking for more specific reporting. That can be done in-house, or do you recommend third parties for that as well? Then on the impact side, I know that you've been working with third parties, and it sounds like, you know, you don't need to spend as where you, from what you say, where you need to spend the most time is on generating the competitive advantage on the way that you are looking at the investments rather than all these other parts.
Yeah, the way we do it is that we use third party for controversy issues. For example, we do get a screening for all of our funds out of the Global Compact controversy issues. So that there is a third or fourth or fifth pair of eyes looking at all the companies and the controversies, so that we get a reporting out of that. So that's something which, because we invest in a lot in emerging markets and in global equities, so that's how we find it very useful to have someone else looking at that for us. The ESG score as such is probably something which we have found very beneficial to be developing our own ESG reporting, because we want to understand what's inside the numbers that we are reporting. Because if you're buying an ESG score, you will never be able to go completely see through the black box of the provider in the assessment and explain why you arrived at that kind of a level of number or whatever. So instead of just relying on numbers, we hope we're able to explain the process and create a narrative, what the fund is doing, how we're engaging with companies, and so forth. So that's our approach there. And impact is something we are investigating very deeply at the moment. It's very interesting. Hopefully we'll get there sometime fairly soon. But that's definitely rather than the direction that where we find interesting.
Okay. Just conscious of time, because you know we only have a few minutes left. There is so much that we can and that we should be kind of digging.
Can I, JP, just to give a kind of a sort of an example of what when you drill down into social and the people angle? Can I just show
yes, please.
The table how that kind of really looks like? And I'm going to jump one slide there. And this is really in order to kind of finish with an idea that you know very often the conversations are very broad based, very general level, but this is what I thought I would show to people who are interested in how the people factor can actually how do you take it into account. This is a typical Miller Modigliani very traditional valuation table where you have on the right-hand side, which is the vertical axis, you have the competitive advantage period and size of the growth opportunities for the company. So the competitive advantage, remember we started with Warren Buffett, that's very important. So that's the, you know, the longer the period or years of competitive advantage you get there further down in that vertical axis. And the size, if the size of the growth opportunities for the company is very, very large relative to the existing asset size, you get also further down in the sort of the higher numbers down the vertical axis. And that's really, so, you know, one way the people factor comes into is to analyze, instead of, you know, just typically what are the technologies, what are the machines, what are the, what's the management like even, but really the people factors, is that, does that prolong and lengthen the period of time that the competitive advantage can be seen in the future, so that you get more there on the, on the, on the vertical axis. On the horizontal axis, we have the spread between weighted average cost of capital and the return on incremental invested capital. And obviously, again, the higher the spread, the more you go to the right-hand side, and the cross-section is where the relevant PE multiple is. So that obviously, if you have a very high return on incremental invested capital and you have a competitive advantage and a massive market size, you end up with the with something close to 100 PE multiples. Those are the extreme cases. And then you can kind of from that table start looking at, you know, the people factor and how that does it actually improve your return on invested incremental capital that you have, people who are driven, find purpose in the company, and will be able to, you know, take every challenge and meet them and get there, you know, does that really impact that number? And also with the competitive advantage period as well, I mean, you know, at the same time, the solution. So this is why technology companies typically have higher multiples, because the opportunities can be quite huge. But at the same time as well, this is really an example of how you can think about the capital, which here is traditionally regarded as, you know, machines, software, buildings, whatever you have, your warehouse and stock. But in my playbook, using sustainability analysis, the people affect the capital in a way which is human capital, because the different, really, when you kind of drill down very deep into these companies, what they're actually doing, what their culture is, how they're scoring, in, for example, the Glassdoor ratings or whatever. I mean, what makes them unique? What makes them special? That people, and people is very critical in many of these, you know, fast growing technology companies. They come in every morning and they leave every evening, and sometimes they leave perhaps altogether. And what kind of an impact does that have? And I've come to the realization that many of the times that I've actually missed and didn't have a, you know, strong enough expectation of where the multiple can go into were examples where I just, you know, early on didn't fully realize that how much capacity there was in that company to produce amazing results after another, one quarter after another, 1 year after another. And that's really sort of evolved me to kind of thinking about the people factor and how it, because that's an accelerator, which is typically not in financial analysis, where you can really put a finger on it that, okay, we have a unique leadership, unique corporate culture, and an ability to acquire the best talent, nurture the best talent, and retain the best talent. Sure enough, you will be probably seeing better numbers on both axes and actually leading into higher justified multiple. Mm-hmm. And that really just goes to show that you can, if you have technologies and methods to analyze the people factor in a systematic fashion. And now with advanced technologies, we will be able to look at companies, their all kinds of communications, use natural language processing, use machine learning, to look at and estimate what is the kind of unstructured data telling us about the company culture and the strengths within the company cultures from signals which are typically weak to traditional financial analysis, but can become really strong when you're using a sustainability analysis, if you have the right tools and ability to use that data to link, put it into something here in that table, which gives you a higher confidence of a higher multiple, for example. So that's I thought would be just, you know, really kind of drill down and see what is actually done and how this works out in practice. This is just one variable.
Yes. We talked about the Glassdoor rating as well, just to finish. But
it's a very
if you can share that with us, and then after that, I would really welcome if you can share a kind of quick advice, you know, to everyone, given, you know, the volatile moment of the market, but most importantly, a call to action for every listener.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Glassdoor is just a very, very, very famous, very simple. I mean, I'm not saying that you should use Glassdoor as an indicator, but it kind of gives you an idea how that has been helping perhaps performance. You can see here that in the chart that over many years, I mean, the return differentials were not that huge. But over the past 3-4 years, you can already begin to see that there's a massive distinction between the better rated Glassdoor companies. And Glassdoor, by the way, is using a lot of advanced technologies to get to the best places to work list of companies. It's not just ratings as such, but they're using technology and algorithms to get there. So it's more advanced than what it used to be. And I've been using Glassdoor myself for, you know, at least 4 years now. And that was something of a revelation to me. I thought nobody was using it, but apparently they are now.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Essa. And one last kind of call to action and advice for the listeners.
My advice is just get going. If you are
panic.
Are you referring to the current market turmoil?
Well, I think that's to start, but then long term, more importantly, about to transition and to push, you know, to scale sustainable investing.
Okay, I'm managing an equity fund. The advice is always to treat your investment in an equity fund as a long-term investment. And, you know, this too will pass at some point of time. With very turbulent times at the moment. But if you have, you should always take a long-term perspective. And I think you can't go really badly wrong if you choose the best companies in the world to kind of go along with, even through this crisis. Time will tell, but I think that's advice number one. The second advice, really get going. I think it's, if you're a stakeholder, if you're one of the trustees of a fund, if you're a pension company stakeholder, make the demand and ask your organization where you have an influence on what are the actions that we're taking to mitigate the other existential threat that is surely coming there down the line if we do nothing. And how do we, as guardians of assets, what are we really doing to get an impact which is net positive and gives actually back to us, the planet, the people, something which is more than what we're using? Because every company is using resources. We're as humans, we're all using resources. But the key question is that what are we doing to make sure that we actually, with our investment, with our capital allocation, we actually get more out of it than we are taking. So that's the key number one. And I think, you know, look at ESG sustainability from a point of view that makes sense to you, that you really believe. Because if you're investing, you really have to have a conviction behind your investment. And, you know, find out alternatives, strategies, processes that you can find comfortable with. And if you're not, I mean, then, you know, there are plenty of choices, you know. it's a free world.
Perfect. And what I would say to people is, you know, this is one of the most exciting opportunities that we are ever going to be gifted as, you know, people in the industry and in the world to solve, you know, the world's most challenging problems in a way that we can, and we get to be a part of it by finding or funding a solution. So please do everything you can. And with that, I will pass back to Dom.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. That was a great webinar. And of course, we had a number of questions coming in, and I know that time being short.
I tried to ask a couple of during the conversation, and I think we answered quite a few of them to Laura and others.
If somebody has a question, I'm still available. So that's
fine. And they can reach out as well to us.
Rick also
asked a question. John asked a question. I dropped those questions in the conversation already.
Okay. Excellent. So, I'll get across the questions that we didn't manage to get to across to JP and across to Etta, and we'll get any of the answers out and along with the recordings that we'll be delivering to you as soon as we can. So with that, I'd just like to point you to the future stuff that we're looking to bring together. So on the 26th of this month, we'll be running another webinar with UBS, Aberdeen Standard Investments, and Oliver Wyman, and that's on climate leaders and climate action. We also have the upcoming conference in London on the 27th and 28th of May, which is ESG Investment Europe. And we'd love to see everybody down at that event also. So just lastly to thank JP and to thank Etta. It's been great to hear from you guys. And hope everybody found this very useful and insightful. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Impact Leaders. Please make sure to subscribe so you receive notification of our coming episodes. Also remember to share with colleagues and friends that are interested to help transition funds into sustainable and impact investing faster and at scale. If you have any questions, do connect with me and reach out to ILM Partners to help your firm and your personal transition. God bless you all, and until the next one.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.